Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We're in Parashat Chukat, which is Numbers 19 through the very first verse of chapter 22. So Numbers 19, Jehovah spoke to Moses, to Aaron, saying, "This is the decree of the Torah, which Jehovah has commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel. They shall take to you a completely red cow, which is without blemish, and upon which a yoke has not come. You shall give it to Eleazar, the Kohen. He shall take it out to the outside of the camp, and someone shall slaughter it in his presence. Eleazar the Kohen shall take some of its blood with his forefinger and sprinkle some of its blood toward the front of the tent of meeting 7 times. So it shall burn the cow before his eyes, its hide, its flesh, and its blood. With its dung he shall burn. The Kohen shall take the cedar wood, hyssop, crimson thread. He shall throw them into the burning of the cow. The Kohen shall immerse his clothing and immerse himself in water, and afterward he may enter the camp, and the Kohen shall remain contaminated until evening. The one who burns it shall immerse his clothing in water and immerse himself in water, and he shall remain contaminated until evening. A pure man shall gather the ash of the cow and place it outside the camp in a pure place. For the assembly of Israel, it shall remain as a safekeeping. For water of sprinkling, it is for purification. The one who gathers the ash of the cow shall immerse his clothing and remain contaminated until evening. It shall be for the children of Israel and for the proselyte who dwells among them as the eternal decree. Whoever touches the corpse of any human being shall be contaminated for 7 days. He shall purify himself with it on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. Then he shall become pure. But if he will not purify himself on the 3rd day and the 7th day, he will not become pure. Whoever touches the dead body of a human being who will have died and will not have purified himself, if he shall have contaminated the tabernacle of Jehovah, that person shall be cut off from Israel. Because the water of sprinkling has not been thrown upon him, he shall remain contaminated. His contamination is still upon him. This is the teaching regarding a man who would die in a tent. And that enters the tent, and that is in the tent, shall be contaminated for 7 days. Any open vessel that has no cover fastened to it, it is contaminated. On the open field, anyone who touches one slain by the sword, or one that died, or a human bone, or a grave, should be contaminated for 7 days. They should take for the contaminated person some of the ashes of the burning of the purification animal, and put spring water in a vessel. A pure man shall take hyssop and dip it in the water, sprinkle it upon the tent, upon all the vessels, upon the people who were there, upon the one who touched the bone, or the slain one, or the one that died, or the grave. The pure person shall sprinkle upon the contaminated person on the 3rd day and on the 7th day, and shall purify him on the 7th day. Then he shall immerse his clothing and immerse himself in water, become purified in the evening. But a man who becomes contaminated and does not purify himself, that person shall be cut off from the midst of the congregation, if he shall have contaminated the sanctuary of Jehovah, because the water of sprinkling has not been thrown upon him, he is contaminated. This should be for them an eternal decree, and the one who sprinkles the water of sprinkling they shall immerse his clothing, and the one who touches the water of sprinkling shall be contaminated until evening. Anything the contaminated one may touch shall become contaminated, and the person who touches him shall become contaminated until evening." We'll stop there for a minute. A lot of little tongue twisters for me today. So in this Torah portion, chapter 19, we have a rather strange sequence of description going on. I say strange because, well, if we look at it closely, there's some oddities in this that seem out of place. First of all, we'll begin with a little bit. Chapter 19 discusses, obviously, the red cow, which is, of course, burned in the ashes and all that stuff mixed for people who are a corpse, or to clean somebody up from a corpse from a dead body. Now, we can discuss the details and the nuances of all the components of the cow's requirements, but I'm going to ask you a few quick questions which should lead this discussion a little bit. First of all, a red cow, is it normal or common to slaughter a female cow? No. What is normal? A male cow. The only time which a female is commanded to be slaughtered is when there is a dead body strewn out in the field and no one knows who killed them. And then the city leaders, the nearest town or nearest village to the dead body, they can measure the distance and figure out who's closest. They're to bring a female cow, and slaughter it and say, we don't know who did it. We did the investigation, couldn't figure out who murdered this person or how the person died. But we're saying we're not guilty because at least we tried and we were unsuccessful in solving this murder. In that instance, a female cow is slaughtered. Otherwise, it isn't. These aren't. There's no command for it, except this instance. So it's unusual to do, but let's some details about this particular cow. First of all, is a cow a clean or unclean animal?
Clean.
So it's a red cow. Oh, by the way, this is commonly referred to as the red heifer. Well, there's technically a difference between a cow and a heifer, and the Torah does use two different descriptive terms. In the Torah portion itself, I misspoke. Not the Torah does. Your Bibles use two different terms. The Torah, it actually specifies cow. It doesn't say it has to be a heifer. The word is listed as cow. However, you go to the New Testament, to the Hebrews, they use the word for heifer. There are other places in Isaiah also refers to heifer that there is a distinction, the cow being one who has produced an offspring, the heifer being one that has not produced an offspring. That's the really distinction between the two of them, right? This is his cow. It can be a heifer or not. It does not have to be. Traditionally, it's been interpreted to only be a heifer, not one who has actually given birth of itself yet, or by itself. So it's a red cow. It's a really clean thing. Now, in the normal sequence of slaughtering a sheep or a goat or anything else, does the process of slaughtering or offering that animal, does that make the priest unclean? Is there any instance you can think of where the priest becomes unclean by slaughtering the animal? Big fat zero. There isn't one. So normally, an offering, if somebody brings the offering, whether it's a cow, whether it's a sheep, a goat, birds, whatever, the priests themselves don't become unclean from the process. Now, they may get blood on their hands, but that's a washing. They themselves aren't rich or symbolically or spiritually unclean from the process. But this one's different. So the red cow itself may be a clean animal, but the process of slaughtering, the process of burning, the process of sprinkling, the process of transportation, that's transporting the ashes or whatever, and the process of storage. Now, normally, none of these things would be, there should be no problem with them. But in our Torah portion, we find out every one of these components are unclean. The slaughtering of it is unclean. The burning of it is unclean. The sprinkling of it is unclean. The transportation, moving things around are unclean. And storing it is unclean. Everything this animal touches, the ashes, everything about it, makes anybody who touched it or was near it, or not say near, you touch it, either directly touch it, like you physically touch it, or use an object, and the object was in your hand, and you touch it with the object, makes you unclean. So it makes all those things. So this cow, which should normally be a clean cow, everything about it should be nothing wrong with it, but in fact, it is transferred in our Torah portion to completely unclean in every instance. That's what's odd. Because in the process of doing this, what's the cow's function to make what is unclean clean? So normally over here, you'd have the corpse on the unclean side. Anybody who touched the corpse, the containers, the people, which were either in the room or was in the vicinity of the tent of the person who died. Obviously the grave, because you have to physically transfer the body to a grave, the transporters, all these people, as well as the vessels, it says any open vessels, what else was it? Who was touched? Touch a slain, or by a sword, grave, or a bone. You touch the bone, like a dead body's bone, or the grave. All these are unclean things. Now, by the way, ignore the word good and bad for now. I'm just saying clean and unclean. The unclean sections, this is all this stuff related to the corpse. It includes the building itself, so the building or tent. This is normally unclean. Now, this clean animal, which is slaughtered and processed, its functionality is completely unclean to those who are clean. So if you are already clean, this animal will make you unclean. The red cow will. But if you are unclean from the corpse, this animal will make you clean. Seems odd, doesn't it? It's like a paradox. How is that possible? How can so which is clean make you unclean, which is that is unclean make you clean again? It's odd. Yes.
Does that have anything to do with they both have blood? They both have not been washed of their body wastes. The red cow is burned in its entirety. It's not been cleaned.
Right. It wasn't washed. The entrails were not washed. Like most offerings, the entrails, the dung is washed away before they, well, most. There are some instances where they burn the dung up too, but they usually that stuff is washed out. That is true. That could be a connection as to why it itself can make you unclean. But how is that process between the red cow, which is unclean to everyone who is clean, how does that process make a person who is unclean from a corpse transfer or move them from the unclean side to the clean side? It seems strange, doesn't it? Yes, Jeff.
Does it have anything to do with what the Apostle Paul said, that the law, even though it's holy, can become death to you?
That's an interesting concept. I hadn't thought about that aspect of it. It's possible. That could be a point which is being referred to here. I'll think about that one. You could have a point there. We'll read about the serpent shortly, because it's also going to play into this section. So I want you to remember, because we're going to move on a little bit on the story, because it's going to come back again, to this strange concept of how somebody who is clean is transferred to unclean side, how someone is unclean is transferred to the clean side, and in this with this cow is this mechanism of which it's supposed to work. Of course, it's obviously symbolic. A ash of a dead animal doesn't do anything. It's just dirt. But this is symbolic, a discussion matter for us. What is God trying to point out to this? Let's see here. So keep this in mind because we come back to it. Because this concept pops up a couple of times in this Torah portion. Yes?
How about giving birth? Because, you know, being birthed between the birth canal, perhaps the blood and everything that they go through having a child, or even animals, they all have blood and they're in a sack and whatever. Perhaps that has to do with being unclean. Or is it just the death?
Okay, so no, there's... talking myself into trouble. So there is a bizarre or strange connection, the Hebrew terms here, which do lend to a contamination in the form of contamination being listed here as a form of a menstruation cycle contamination, that concept. So that is the type of contamination you are contaminated with when it comes to the red cow. So that as opposed to, like, you know, I touched an unclean animal, that's one classification of contamination. In this case, I touched the red cow that's been in the process of being slaughtered. I'm unclean the same way a female is unclean during her menstruation cycle. So there is some kind of a connection there. I'm not going to go too much detail with it because I don't want to go there today. There's something else I want to talk about. No, you're not off on off a weirdness. You're actually, there is a connection there, but I don't want to talk about that today. Yes.
Yeah, it says in Hebrews 9:13, for if the blood of bulls and of goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies to the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?
So in that con, which we'll be hitting there later on today as well, if I have time for it. So in this con, which you just cited off, it lists, of course, the blood of the animals and the goats and or the cows and such, as well as red heifer for flesh. Note that in Messiah's death, his functionality focused, the death process, was it focused to clean someone who was unclean from a corpse? Or was his death process the function of cleaning someone from their uncleanness due to their sins, transgressions, and iniquities? See, those are two different things, aren't they? Because I myself obviously can still sin, but the concept of unclean from a corpse is the corpse is unclean. You touched it. It is an unclean thing. Not from your evil or incorrupt, not from your sins, your transgression, iniquities, actions unclean. These are two different types of uncleanliness. Mind you, in the Torah, there's a whole list of different kinds of uncleanness. There's unclean animals. There's unclean actions, sins, transgression, iniquities. There's unclean bodily fluids. They all mean different things, the different kinds of uncleanness. Yes, Daniel.
Would you comment on verse 6, please? Because it... Hyssop and scarlet are both connected with...
Yes. Yeah.
Like cleansing.
Okay. So actually, that's good that you talk about that, because that one of the many highlights we're going to talk about today is this concept, which we're going into next anyway. Oh, yes. Go ahead, Jonathan.
I was going to say with ashes, it's... Yeah. I don't know. Going back into history, that was how they first made soap.
It is soap, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's highly alkaline. So, you know, you can't have the germs and bacteria around that type
Correct.
Of substance.
Correct. It is soap. So, he's making lye water, a type of soap. It's lye water.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how soap lye water is made, is ashes. They usually don't use animals for that. Animal ash, usually like wood ash. Today we use wood ash or plant ash. But the animal ash is the same principle. It'll still do the same thing. It is lye water is what he's manufacturing. So what Daniel's question was, or comment was, regarding the hyssop, the cedar wood, and the crimson thread, those the same components used for curing leprosy. So we have hyssop. I misspelled the two S's or one S? One, okay. The two S? Ugh, whatever. Hyssop, there's cedar wood, and crimson thread or red yarn. Oh, the thread. Now, these components, if you add water, note, when you add water, that's the same process. The red cow has water, the ash water. If you add spring water, or actually living waters more specifically, water. Now, in the case of the leper, you have to have two birds. There's two birds. One's dead, one's alive. They kill one, the one was set free. This process is what's used for curing leprosy. Not curing it, sorry. Cleansing one from after they've gotten over the leprosy. It's more accurate. It doesn't cure it, it's just a process of cleansing it. These similar components, with the exception of two birds, are also being used here in the red cow process of the cleaning from a corpse. All right? So clearly there's a connection which God's making with these components. Now, not all these components, but some of them are also used in particular, the hyssop, because in this process of the cleaning of the leprosy, one of the birds is converted into blood. And the other one is set free. Oh, sorry, it's off the chart. One bird is converted to blood here, slaughtered, and the other one is set free in a nearby field. All right? That's the case with the two birds. Now, there are similarities between the leprosy concept, what's going on in leprosy, as well as what's happening here at the red cow, the red heifer process. And there's also similarities for Day of Atonement with the two goats, because the same thing happens with the birds, what happens with the goats. So God is connecting all these things together. So we have, I'm going to come back to this page in a minute. We have certain connections obviously made. So we've got, let's move this thing over here. We have the red cow. We have the hip leprosy. Can spell correct terribly. And then we have the atonement or Yom Kippur. All of these are not identical, but they have similarities. I mean, there are certain components that are transferred around and shuffled around with inside them. What is their overall theme behind these? Oh, by the way, sorry, one more thing here I forgot. There's also a fourth one, a part of the Passover service. Sorry. Part of the Passover service is connected to the Passover, meaning the hyssop being used to dip in the blood and spread on doorposts. So we have, there are elements that are being shuffled around and intermixed all these. Anyone want to take a guess what these four seem, the overall theme behind all four of them? What's their overall theme? What do they do? What is a red cow? What's the process of red cow? What's it supposed to do? To clean you, right? Cleanse you. The red cow, of course, is from the corpse. All of them do it to some degrees, in different ways. The leprosy, of course, cleanses you from the leper. These are all cleaning. And of course, Yom Kippur cleanses you from what? Your iniquities, more specific to certain kinds of sin, which is the more the wickedness or the intentional, I want to sin, those types of things, which is Yom Kippur. So it's all for sins. And Passover is the other kind of sin. Which one's that one? Completely covered. You know nothing about it. Covers wrong. That's for atonement. These are the ones which you do nothing for it. Meaning God does all of this one. So Passover is God does all the stuff that your past is being as if you're starting over again. Yom Kippur, you knew better. Passover, you didn't know better, right? Those are the two distinctions between these two values. Passover, I don't know anything what I'm doing wrong, right or wrong. I'm just lost. Yom Kippur, as I knew full well what I was doing was wrong. Right, there's two different types. So there's many kinds of contamination, three kinds of sins, many kinds of transgressions. Right, so these are all they do for sins, but this what the Yom Kippur is for iniquities, and Passover is more for generic or general sins. So there's different kinds of those, but they're all designed for cleaning or taking these items away from you, from your issues. Yes, Sean.
Can you be faster next time? Thank you.
Just kidding. Just kidding.
Forgot what you were going to say.
I mean, the feasts up here, the coverings, as you're just describing, the two different attributes of Yom Kippurim and, mm-hmm. and Pesach. Mm-hmm. But all these, as you're pointing to the one thing that says clean,
right?
This is about a thought process, about a renewing of a heart, taking out the stoniness.
With inside the person.
Exactly. Right. I mean, because I mean, for a long time, I kept getting tripped up thinking it was about the mechanisms of the cow, of the way it was clean. I mean, right. These are the blueprints, mm-hmm. definitely, but it's to lead, which I think the commentary, what we call the New Testament, mm-hmm. of
this yeah. The New Testament does comment on this section a couple of times. Obviously, the reference, which in Hebrews 9, as well as, of course, John 3, talks about some of these elements as well. It is a commentated on section, because New Testament is a commentary on the Tanakh, essentially. It explains all the details going on in there. So we have these examples, and these interconnected components, these four main things we're discussing here today, are connected with this concept of what is wrong with the inside person. Because honestly, every one of us know if I touch ash water, yeah, there's a little lie in it, that is true. Does that make me pure from any kind of contamination I got? Does it make me dirty, clean or dirty? Does it do anything to me? Not a whole lot. I mean, yeah, there are probably some germs on my hands that might kill off. It is a lie. That's what ultimately going to do. Does it fix anything inside of me? No. What's it supposed to do then? Well, it's not an outward fix. This has to be an internal concept what's going on here. So in all of these elements, we have these connections of cleanliness. The strange parts are, well, all the strange parts, they all have their idiosyncrasies. In this case, the red cow one is the one that's the oddest of them, in that the operator, the person who's actually doing the process, becomes unclean in the process. while the other three, the operator who's doing the process, does not become unclean in the process. So there's an oddity, but each have their own idiosyncrasies. Each one of them have their own elements that are strange to them, or such strange, are unique to them. Yes, Daniel.
So something that just occurred to me was that they all have in common to remember.
Yes.
A remembrance, we are unclean and we need cleansing, even if it's only symbolically clean. It's a reminder.
It is.
Our true state.
It is. It is a reminder. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit more on the next couple of chapters, because there's some components which we're going to see. There's more than just this idiosyncrasy of the red cow thing, making the clean person unclean, or the good, the bad, the good, and vice versa interaction that's going on here in the rest of the Torah portion, as well as our Haftorah portion, which also talks about similar issues. So we're going to read a little bit further in here, and we're going to come back to these, and we're going to add to our, or flesh out some of our concept of what God's trying to teach us. So let's jump to chapter 20. Now, in this instance, we're going to go through, obviously, the death of Miriam, and of course, Aaron, and Moses and Aaron's error. So, chapter 20, their first really interaction with a close corpse. The children of Israel, the whole assembly, arrived in the wilderness of Zin. In the first month that the people settled at Kadesh, Miriam died there, and she was buried there. There was no water for the assembly, and they gathered against Moses and Aaron. The people quarreled with Moses and spoke up, saying, "If only we had perished as our brethren perished before Jehovah. Why have you brought the congregation of Jehovah to this wilderness to die there, we and our animals? Why did you bring us up from Egypt to bring us to this evil place? Not a place of seed or fig or grape or pomegranate, and there is no water to drink." Moses and Aaron went to the presence of the congregation to the entrance of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. The glory of Jehovah appeared to them. Jehovah spoke, saying, "Take the staff and gather together the assembly, you and Aaron, your brother, and speak the rock before their eyes, that it shall give its water. You bring forth for them water from the rock and give drink to the assembly and to their animals." Moses took the staff before Jehovah, as he had commanded him. Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation before the rock, and he said to them, "Listen now, O rebels, shall I bring forth water for you from this rock?" Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock with his staff twice. Abundant water came forth in the assembly, and their animals drank. Jehovah said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not believe in me to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you will not bring this congregation to the land that I have given them. They are the waters of strife, where the children of Israel contended with Jehovah, and he was sanctified through them." Stop there for a minute. Now this is another odd story within inside this Torah portion. An odd story meaning it is somewhat, not impossible, but somewhat difficult to narrow down precisely what it was God was mad at with regard to Moses and Aaron. We have our speculations. There's a billion and one commentaries out there, probably 2 billion by now, as far as each person's opinion as to what precisely was it that God got mad at. Was it the fact he struck? Was it the fact he was angry? Was it the fact he called them rebels? All those different components. Was it this? Was it that? Was it a combination of them? What did God say was a problem? All those details, people have different opinions of it. Yes.
Verse 12.
Because you did not trust me.
So what precisely was it that he didn't trust?
And his what are the word, actions? His directions.
And what in the actions was it, or what are the things that was it that he said he did that was the error? Was the error?
I must admit something. To me, it just means because bottom line, it's always about a heart and mind issue. If you don't trust me, the rest is off the table.
In what component though? What precisely? You started out, but you didn't finish it off.
So hitting the rock twice.
Okay, so he hit the rock.
Not once.
Right, not once.
Twice.
Right.
To double. Got you.
So this is what I pointed this out to you, because this is it's a strange scenario. So think back. Well, actually, we just go back there to Exodus 17. So the previous time Moses did this same trick, I use that term on purpose, not flippantly. Yeah. So Moses performed this action before. In the previous time, Moses had done this before. He did it with the previous generation. This is roughly 38 to 40 years earlier. We could debate the exact year. So Exodus 17, the congregation of the children of Israel set on their journey from the wilderness of Zin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim. There was no water for people to drink. People contended to Moses, said, "Give us water, we drink." Moses said, "Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord?" And people thirst there for water. The people murmured against Moses, "Why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children's livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me." Jehovah said to Moses, "Go on before the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel. Take with your hand your rod, which you struck the river, and go. Behold, I'll stand you there at the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it. And the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because the contention of the children of Israel, because they tempted Jehovah, saying, "It is Jehovah among us or not." So Moses did this trick before. So he's going about the second time around. Okay, we do this trick again. But there was a subtle difference. Now God commanded him to take the staff. God said, "Take the staff." Both times, go take the staff. Do this, take the staff. So Moses perceived, "Oh, we're going through this trick again. Okay, look, we did it once. Oh, I'll do it again. Okay, strike." So intuitively, if you were Moses, think about it. Have you done this before? It's like driving a car or riding a bicycle. "Oh, I know how to do this," and go do it again. Because, "Oh, that's not what I wanted. That's not what God wanted." There's a subtle difference here. It doesn't seem odd. Mind you, God is very merciful and forgiving and kind and all these great things. This seems, relatively speaking, a minor error. Yes.
Well, I was just going to say, as you were leading up to, he was not told to strike the rock this time.
Right.
He was told to speak to it.
Right. But he was still told to command. He was commanded still to take the rod with him to do it.
But that has nothing to do with it, right? And then he hit it again. Apparently, didn't work the first time.
Right. I guess he didn't work the first time.
Could have been the same. Could have been the same rock that he did to it once before. It has the same name. They named it.
That's why they say the rock.
The rock, yeah. The
You've
rock.
Been walking around, and I got back to the same place.
Yeah, it is the rock. It's not like the unknown rock. There's the one rock. He probably is the same rock. So of the great crimes and sins of Moses, of course there aren't that many, other than, of course, he killed the Egyptian, all that kind of stuff, but there are only a few things he did that were an error in his life. This seems a relatively minor one. Right, because the closer you get to God, the more scrutiny he looks at you with.
Yeah.
Remember Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's two sons?
Yeah.
He warned, "Those who are closest to me, I look more clearly." It's not like God has glasses. You're too far away, it's kind of fuzzy, you're somewhere out there. You look close, "Oh, I can see you." It's the same concept. "Oh, yeah. Don't look too close, God." "Don't look too close." That's the same idea, that the closer you are to him, the more scrutiny there is, there's more requirements upon you, he's more stringent, and the narrower the gap becomes as far as what you can and cannot do. Now, mind you, this is the same man, Moses, who told God, "You're wrong. Don't do that." And God said, "Okay." So this is the same man who humbly goes for God and says, "Don't do that. This is the wrong thing to do." He goes toe-to-toe with God a couple of times. And God relents. God backs down. It's okay. I'll do it your way. So this is not man who is unaware or God does not respect. He does respect him because God listens to him. Yes, Deborah.
So, you know, what's so confusing is that God wanted to get rid of all of them. Let me just get rid of them
more
all
than
and
once.
Make a new. Yeah,
more than once.
Over and over. So Moses has heard this. And I would presume, too, if I was hanging out with a particular person that said, "Let me get rid of them." Or, you know, that happens when you hang out with somebody. But if somebody else says something about them, you're like, "Hey, that's my mom. That's my dad. That's my brother." You know, so I thought it was strange. I was thinking, well, God wanted to get rid of them. Perhaps Moses had come to the same conclusion.
Now, mind you, amongst the many theories on what's going on in this, there's a whole host of them. Can we have everything all combined? God's complaint specifically says that Moses and Aaron, because you did not hallow or sanctify me in this action. You didn't believe me and sanctify me. Now, mind you, at the end of verse 13, God was still sanctified. I mean, the people themselves still gave him what he was after. It says, they are the waters of strife, for the children of Israel contended with Jehovah, and he was sanctified through them. So even though Moses and Aaron did not sanctify God, because they didn't believe him as God had commanded them to do so, it's still the people themselves still did so. Now that should tell you something, because this is a second generation of people. This is not the same ones that were there 40 years ago. Most of them are now dead. Not all, but most. So this is a new generation, and this new generation apparently has a different mentality. Not like night and day different, but a little bit different than their previous or their parents had. Okay? So there's a different culture going on here. I say this because if any of you haven't noticed, you probably will now if you haven't done it before, because I'm sure everybody has noticed at some point in their lives. Back with the 10 spies, remember that story of the 10 spies? There was two names conspicuously missing when God said, no one in this generation will make it through except Joshua and Caleb. What other two names were missing? Moses and Aaron. Well, why wouldn't they? They believed in Josh. They agreed with Joshua and Caleb, right? Well, how come God didn't say, except Joshua and Caleb and Moses and Aaron? What did God know 40 years ago? He knew they weren't going. God knew they weren't going. He knew ahead of time they weren't going. But yeah, Moses and Aaron would have known too. Why weren't our names mentioned? So they knew something's wrong. This was, I won't use the word predestined because that's a garbage word, but this was almost pre-planned. Something was going to happen. The God had set up and knew what was going to occur. We say, well, God knows everything. Yeah, he does. And some things, well, but what about free will? All that stuff, yada, 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 blah, blah, blah. Reality is, when you're a really important person, you're very, very close to God. And guess what? He looks at you very thoroughly. And there are some things he sees in us that we don't like, but he sees it anyway. He knew what Moses and Aaron were going to be doing. My opinion, this is Daniel's opinion, God already knew 40 years earlier this event was going to occur, or something like it. Yes, Daniel.
So is there an implication here about you can treat God one way in your private when it's just you and him, but when you're in a public, because he makes the point of saying, because he did this in the eyes of the people.
The people, right. There is a distinction. With the close, much like you did with your father, your own dad. When you're in private conversation with him versus amongst your siblings, you may have a different tone of voice or a different conversation, more intimate or more detailed than you would when there's many people that's in the audience. The more formal there's an audience. So that there's no different. God it did not make us so distinctly different from him in how we perceive others, how we treat others. The whole point of all this stuff is a community to dwell with God. So we're going to interact with him the way he designed us to interact with each other. Yes, Anne.
Well, looking down generations later, David, the king, and Solomon, and David was told, you will not build this temple.
Right. You can't come that close to me, David.
You are too violent, right, or too much bloodthirsty. Right. And so leadership is treated differently.
They are. And that's an important thing to focus on, because in the case of King David, I think what's inherently wrong with him in and of himself, there's nothing wrong with him by himself. But God has said, okay, David, the closer you get to me, as we learned with Aaron's two sons, as God explained quite clearly, the closer you get to me, the more stringent my requirements become. And I'm going to require tighter and tighter tolerances on what you do. Well, in David's case, God said, oh, you can't fit. My tolerances are so narrow and you're so big, it won't fit in this. So you can't do this, David. You're too dirty. You're too much blood on your hands. So you cannot come that close. Solomon, however, you don't have that much blood. You can fit inside my requirement. You can come that close and build this temple. So there are differences. God knows these men as they're young and as they're growing. It's not that God isn't with all of them. They're still with them. But it doesn't mean he's allowed to come too close to him. Why? If you get too close, what happens? You die. Does God want you dead? No. He says, okay, that's close enough. Stop. Now live. Don't come any closer, because unfortunately you won't live. Does it make sense? Okay, yes. Larry.
You know, I was going to say, if Moses had led them into the promised land, he was too close to being messianic, actually. he would have not been had anything that would have separated him from the Messiah.
Right.
I don't think it's any coincidence that Yahshua's name is the same as Yeshua's name. Mm-hmm. Because he's the one that actually led them in, but he was the warrior leader, not the sacrificing leader.
Right. You're absolutely right. God had planned on this ahead of time. In my personal opinion, again, I think Moses knew it. Like Moses knew or had some inkling this is going to be happening. Just my personal opinion. I could be totally off on that. Yeah, exactly. The humblest man ever walked the earth. So that's impressive. Well, Messiah was pretty humble too. At his time, the humblest at his time. Fair enough. Okay, so I point this out to you because let's go back to our red cow, clean, unclean thing. And it may seem like a non sequitur, but it isn't. So in this strange scenario of Moses and the people were looking for salvation. In this case, lack of water. They wanted water. They were looking to some save them, to help me. Get me out of this situation because I'm going to die. Now, mind you, I personally have never been in the desert. I just haven't. Some of you may have been. Have you ever been in the desert and there's no water for you to drink? You go to a store and buy water, right? What if there isn't a store? What if there isn't a bottle of water with you?
Yes.
Yeah, you become really thirsty all of a sudden, don't you? Hey, how many of you on Yom Kippur, as a night clip, you drink, you're happy, okay, sunsets, and like an hour later, man, I'm thirsty. I'm parched all of a sudden. What happened? Because now you know you can't have water. your mind tells you, I'm thirsty. Well, the same kind of concept happens, so I've been told, in the desert. Oh, I have plenty of water, not a problem, I'm out of water. Man, I'm thirsty all of a sudden. Your mind takes over. So wait a minute. Now that you don't have the resource, now it's a problem. Now, when you had it before, you didn't care, but now you don't. Now it's an issue. In this case, they're going through the desert. I was fine before the previous campsites, but now I don't need water. Oh, no. Now, mind you, being in a desert environment with lack of water is far more severe than where we live in our modern-day cities and towns. We just go to a local store, and water's all around us, and turn the tap on, it spits water out. They didn't have those options. And the temperature's a lot worse. So their sense of fear of death is now popping up on them. Yes, Deborah.
I wanted to say we could all relate to this. When it's time to go to the get your blood drawn, and you're not allowed to eat, you have to fast. And as soon as you do, gosh, I wake up so thirsty, and I'm just like, forget it, I'm not going to do it today. You know, so I know we can all relate to when it's time to do that.
Yep. So we've all gone through varying degrees of this. But I want to point out the oddity of this, which comes back to our red cow corpse thing, is that these people were looking for a type of salvation. They said, this is an evil place, there's no food, no figs, no grapes, pomegranates, blah, 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 no water to drink. Why didn't we die in the wilderness with everybody else? As they were wandering around, we'd be better off there instead of going through this process. In the process of Moses and Aaron delivering them, Moses and Aaron become undelivered. You notice that? In the process with the people receiving water, now we discussed the detail about the striking rock thing. The concept is the process which Moses and Aaron used to deliver the people from their lack of water, that technique, the method which they chose, delivered them, Moses and Aaron, into removing their promise. They became essentially, conceptually or symbolically, unclean themselves. So the people became clean. In the process, Moses and Aaron became unclean. Do you notice that? That's the same strange phenomenon the red cow does. the process which the person becomes clean makes a processor unclean. Odd, isn't it? It's not odd. Go ahead. It shouldn't be odd, but go ahead.
Well, I'm reminded recently I heard about this in Hebrews 5, 7. Mm-hmm. I was talking about Messiah, and it says, and he was heard because of his reverent fear. That little phrase I'd never really hear. His reverence. God heard him because of Jesus' reverence mm-hmm. for the Father. Mm-hmm. So here's an example of, you forgot the reverence.
Mm-hmm. Right. In the method which they did, the method which they chose to follow, I'm using them both. I don't know what part Aaron partook in it, because Moses was the one doing it. But the method which both those men used did take away their deliverance, their inheritance, which is the territory which they were going to deliver these people into. I don't know how much would be their personal inheritance as many difference, because it wasn't divvied up that way yet. But whatever they lost that process, and their process of doing so was the culprit, or the technique, the sequence, what caused it to happen. But my point is that this story is tucked in next to the red heifer story on purpose, because both concepts are shoved together. Mind you, our Torahs are not written chronologically. They're written subject matter based. So the subject matter of the red heifer and the subject matter of this screw up with Moses and Aaron are shoved together because they cover the same subject. What is the subject? What's the concept being relayed to us? What was that? Salvation, but through it, the technique of salvation, of you being saved, is going to cost the saver something. Some innocent thing he's going to say. That same conscience is together. And this innocent creature is not, before in the past, the sacrifice we realize the innocent creature, well, it's the goat, or it's the sheep, or it's the cow that I offered. That poor thing died. Well, these concepts just showed up. No, it's not limited to just the animal that's the innocent creature. The person themselves who's helping you, they themselves are also the sufferer in the process. That concept's being shoved together. I bring this up because it's important to, that's going to happen in the Haftor portion, which I want to read. Let's see, I'll get to, before I get there though, let's see here. Jump through, I'm going to skip the whole permission, try to get through the city of, the territory of Edom through the rest of chapter 20. There's a little bit more, let's go to the tail end of chapter 20. Starting in verse 22. Numbers 20, verse 22. They journeyed from Kadesh, and the children of Israel arrived, the entire assembly at Mount Hor. Jehovah said to Moses and Aaron at Mount Hor by the border of the land of Edom, saying, Aaron shall be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land that I have given to the children of Israel, because you defied my word at the waters of strife. Take Aaron and Eleazar his son, bring them up to the Mount Hor, strip Aaron of his vestments, and dress Eleazar his son in them. Aaron shall be gathered in and die there. Moses did as Jehovah commanded. They ascended Mount Hor before the eyes of the entire assembly. Moses stripped Aaron's garments from him and dressed Eleazar his son in them. Then Aaron died there on the top of the mountain. Moses and Eleazar descended from the mountain. When the entire assembly saw Aaron had perished, they wept for Aaron 30 days, the entire house of Israel. Oh, I just bring that up, although it's not necessarily part what I want to go to next, but I would just point out that Aaron received his correction, the lack of removing his inheritance. He didn't inherit property, but his role was removed almost immediately or very shortly thereafter this concept. So shortly after they had moved on, he died shortly thereafter. Moses, of course, will die in the book of Deuteronomy as he goes through his long oration in that book. So let's continue on though. I just wanted to cover that part. You realize that Aaron does in fact die. The people feel sad about it and such, but that's not the point. So they continue on the rest of the Torah portion, discussing they travel from this town, that town. They go to the next two kings, Amorites. And the Amorites, which this is how it's connected to our Haftorah portion, which we're going to explain this more red heifer cow thing in the Haftorah portion. The Amorites, of course, own a territory which they, you could argue justifiably or unjustifiably, took and stole from Ammon and Moab, because there was a fight going on there, and they had taken territory. Well, so Sihon and Og, the two kings, of course, come out to attack, and the story, though, of course, goes on that they fight, and of course, Sihon and Og are both killed, and their people are killed. And of course, the territory is taken over. This is the section that becomes the inheritance for Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. That's the territory that this area has taken. Wanted to cover that because that's relevant to our Haftorah portion. Is this territory comes into question, and then another unusual character shows up, which ties into our Moses and Aaron, good, clean, unclean, as well as the oddities of this red cow. So in this regarding the territory that they took over, jump to Judges, or Haftorah portion, chapter 11. So Judges 11, we read about a particular man. We've covered him years ago in great detail. So this is going to be a more cursory, descriptive covering of this. Now, Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor, but he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead begot Jephthah. Gilead's wife bore sons, and when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out, and said to him, "You shall have no inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman." Then Jephthah fled from his brothers and dwelt in the land of Tov, and worthless men banded together with Jephthah and went out raiding with him. Stop there for a minute. What is the kind of character that Jephthah is? A bandit, right? Like David, a little bit like David, isn't he? Is he a holy, honorable, justified man? No, not at all. Not that we can tell. Now, were the other sons of Gilead, were they justified in driving Jephthah out? This is an important Torah question. Now, inheritance, is it determined, inheritance from the father to the son, is it determined by the mother or by the father? Firstborn father, right? Now, Jephthah appears to be the firstborn of a harlot woman. Now, it says, then Gilead's wife bore sons, and they grew up. So they were younger. But Gilead's wife, the first wife, their children are supposed to receive their inheritance. But Jephthah's the firstborn son. So what would normally go to Jephthah versus everybody else? He gets a double portion. So the firstborn son gets a double what any of his brothers do. So if you have five sons, all your property is divided up into six equal parts. One son gets 2/6 and the others get 1/6. So the oldest gets double what any of the others get. Right? That's how it's divvied up. That's who you would normally divvy this up. What were these sons doing to Jephthah? You will have no inheritance. You're getting nothing. Get out. So driving him away. What does he do? Does he protest? Well, not much you can protest when people are out to, you know, with pitchforks and swords, you're usually going to run. He takes off. And he goes and finds another way of life, another business. What's his new business? Raiding. He's a raider. He's a bandit. That's his new line of business, new line of work. He's a very versatile person. But that's what this strange, clean, unclean, good, bad thing happens in our Torah portion. Now it came to pass after a time, the people of Ammon made war against Israel. And so it was, the people of Ammon made war against Israel, that the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tov. They said to Jephthah, "Come, be our commander, we may fight against the people of Ammon." Now, this should strike you as a little odd. They don't like the man. He's a bandit. He's a raider. Unscrupulous individual. He has friends that you'd want to get away from. These are not good men. These are murderers, killers, thieves. But that characteristic is what's going to save us. Your evilness, your corruption, your bad behavior is what we need to save us, to help us, to fix our problems. Sounds odd, doesn't it? It should sound odd. Let's continue on. This is a very fascinating story. I love, he's a great character for different reasons. I am now in verse 7. Well, my verse 7. So you have to say to the elders, did you not hate me and expel me from my father's house? Why have you come to me now when you are in distress? The elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, that is why we have turned again to you now, that you may go with us and fight against the people of Ammon and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, if you take me back home to fight against the people of Ammon and Jehovah delivers them to me, shall I be your head? The elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, Jehovah will be a witness before us if we do not do according to your words. Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and commander over them. And Jephthah spoke all his words before Jehovah in Mizpah. So Jephthah made a deal. You want me to save you, I'm going to get something out of it. Right? What was that? He's a hustler. Yeah, he's going to get something out of it. I'll be in charge of everything that you guys do, right? This is the story. It continued on. Now Jephthah sent messengers to the king of Ammon. Now, by this portion here, is Jephthah knows his history. There's a history lesson in the next few verses. Saying, what have you against me that you have come to fight against me in my land? The king of the people of Ammon answered the messengers of Jephthah, that because Israel took away my land when they came out of Egypt from the Arnon, as far as Jabbok, and to the Jordan, now therefore restore those lands peaceably. So Jephthah again sent messengers to the king of the people of Ammon, said to him, thus says Jephthah, Israel did not take away the land of Moab, nor the land of the people of Ammon. For when Israel came up from Egypt, they walked through the wilderness as far as the Red Sea and came to Kadesh. Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, please let me pass through your land. The king of Edom would not heed, and in like manner they sent messengers to the king of Moab, but he would not consent, so Israel remained at Kadesh. They went along through the wilderness and bypassed the land of Edom and the land of Moab and came to the east side of the land of Moab and encamped on the other side of the Arnon. But they did not enter the border of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, king of Heshbon, and Israel said to him, please let us pass through your land and your place. But Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory, so Sihon gathered all his people together and came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. The Lord our God, Jehovah, delivered Sihon to Israel and all his people into the hand of Israel. They defeated them, and thus Israel gained possession of all the land of the Amorites who inhabited that country. They took possession of all the territory, the Amorites, the Arnon, the Jabbok, the wilderness, the Jordan. So now Jehovah, God of Israel, has dispossessed the Amorites from before his people Israel. Should you then possess it? Will you not possess whatever Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? So whatever the Jehovah, our God, takes possession before us, we will possess. And now are you any better than Balak, the Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive against Israel? Did he ever fight against them? While Israel dwelt in Heshbon, its villages in Aroer, and its villages in all the cities along the banks of the Arnon for 300 years, why did you not recover them within that time? Therefore, I have not sinned against you, but you wronged me by fighting against me. May you be the judge and render judgment this day between the children of Israel and the people of Ammon. However, the king of the people of Ammon did not heed the words that Jephthah had sent to him. So what's Jephthah just say? Hey, we didn't take your stuff. We didn't take your territory. When we arrived, you weren't there. The Amorites were. They took it from you. We took it from the Amorites. It's not our fault you lost them. We didn't make you lose the war against the Amorites. That was your problem. But we defeated them. So now it's ours. Our God helped us. We keep it. You want it back? Have your God give it to you. That's what he's telling you. We didn't do it. We have our history. The Torah, but I didn't read. It's recorded. The same thing's recorded. That's why I didn't read it there, because it's recorded here as well. We didn't take from you. We didn't do anything wrong. You lost it to somebody else. We took it from them. You can't have it back now, because it's been 300 years. Wow. 300 years we've had it. It's a little bit late, just a little bit beyond the statute of limitations, where for territory is no longer yours anymore, right? So there's a requirement. You can't come about and demand it now. So mind you, as I mentioned before, what kind of character is Jephthah? What kind of man is he? Note, he's knowledgeable in his own history. He knows his Torah. He knows what happened. That's worth something. He is a firstborn to Gilead. So that's also worth financial value. His brothers can't stand him, didn't want him, didn't like him. He is a ruthless individual type of character as far as a raider, a bandit, one who steals, robs, or potentially murders. I'm not sure he's a murderer or not, but his other men probably were. So his character is not a great character. But something about him is what the people themselves need. The character that makes him not a great character, not a great person, is the characteristic that they need to save them. That is what they need. Note, it will be refined. It does get refined. It will be refined a little bit later in this chapter, actually. So the strange oddity is that that which is unclean or not good is what they need to make them good. Odd, isn't it? The same theme, hence is the Haftor portion for this Torah portion, both for history, but also thematically. The idea that something that isn't good, the red heifer cow, which isn't good to anybody who's clean, is what you actually need to make you clean, to save you, to make you better. It costs that thing, that unclean thing is required to make you clean. Jephthah, this unclean character, is required to save them. Odd. It should be odd. Because we don't usually interpret or think that bad produces good. We usually think good produces good and bad produces bad. But in our Torah portion and in this Haftor portion, we're realizing, wait a minute, it's not that clear cut, is it? Bad can produce good, given the right circumstance, can't it? We can see that. How do we know that? Well, look at the prophets. How bad was Nebuchadnezzar? Pretty bad, wasn't he? Did he accomplish God's will? Absolutely. Is God's will always good? Yes, it's good, not necessarily good for the recipient. The recipient may not like think it's good, but God's will is always good. So God can use that which is bad to produce that which is good. Yes, Sean.
Just more of a personal that I can relate with that. You mentioned when you're talking about David not having too much blood on his hands.
Right.
So just real quick, I mean, I grew up with some pretty horrific things, you know, a lot of us have, a lot of different types of abuse, which I learned some patterns that going into my young adulthood and adulthood. Just snowballed. But through a lot of pain and suffering that I learned.
The quote bad, you just go loose. The pain meaning pain is not a positive thing for us. But look what it does to you.
No, but it actually turned out to be a beautiful
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. It fixes.
What I thought would literally crush me, especially mm-hmm. after that divorce, I didn't think I was going to be able to come back. I shouldn't be sitting here today, especially the muck I went running right afterwards. But that pain drives you closer to God because you realize, on my own, I can't do nothing with mm-hmm. this, and it's only getting worse.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It only gets scary. Only more get caught up in fear and 100 different manifestations of illusions that pop out from that. So, yeah, it's like, I need you, Abba. because I know the darkness too well.
Right. So it's interesting that those negativity, those bad things, I'm using sort of bad loosely. I'm not saying bad as in it's evil. Bad as in it is positive versus something is negative. Hurt, ouch, this hurts, that's a negative. Doesn't mean it's wrong for me. It just means it's negative because it feels pain, right? That's when you use the term good and bad in that way. So that's the term. So those bad things that cause pain, we think, oh, I don't want to hurt. Well, exactly. I don't want to hurt. Therefore, I change my behavior. So therefore, the bad thing, the pain, was good for me. Not saying in itself is good, but it's good for me, right? So we're learning this from Jephthah as well. Now, he has to learn the lesson just like all of us do. Oh, sorry, your hand was up? Oh, okay.
Well, I was just going to say, there's a scripture in the New Testament, I think Paul said it, he is able to make good come even out of evil.
Exactly, which is exactly what he's done, what he's doing. Exactly what he's doing. Verse 29 of Judges 11 says, then the spirit of Jehovah came upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and passed through Mizpah of Gilead. From Mizpah of Gilead, he advanced toward the people of Ammon. Jephthah made a vow to Jehovah, said, if you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace, the people of Ammon surely shall be Jehovah's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. So Jephthah advanced toward the people of Ammon to fight against them, and then Jehovah delivered them into his hands, and he defeated them from Aroer as far as Minnith, 20 cities, and to Abel-Karim with a very great slaughter. Thus the people of Ammon were subdued before the children of Israel. When Jephthah came to his house, Mizpah, there was his daughter coming out to meet him with timbrels and dancing, and she was his only child. Beside her he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass, when he saw her, that he tore his clothes, said, alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to Jehovah that I cannot go back on it. So she said to him, my father, if you have given your word to Jehovah, do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, because Jehovah has avenged you of your enemies, the people of Ammon. Then she said to her father, let this thing be done for me, let me alone for 2 months, that I may go out and wander on the mountains and bewail my virginity, my friends and I. So he said, go. He sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her friends and bewailed her virginity on the mountains. And it was so, at the end of 2 months, she returned to her father. He carried out his vow with her, which he had vowed. She knew no man, and it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went 4 days each year to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite. Oh, that was Judges chapter 11. It's a fascinating story. I know it's very morbid, but it's a fascinating story because we learn something very interesting in this concept. Similar, it's a story as well. The concept, note what's going on though, in the theme of what we're studying. That which is good is also that which converts into being bad. Because I mentioned before that the pain, ouch, the pain, the hurt, changed our behavior, right? And we improve. But what does it cost the one who's hurting you? Someone must hurt me to make me hurt. I myself am not going to poke my own hand. Somebody else has to do it. I use the citation of Nebuchadnezzar, right? Brutal man. But he did what God wanted done. But what did it cost Nebuchadnezzar? His whole mind. So even though these good and bad things are exchanging, the badness produced something good, but the badness receives something also good and also negative, just like the cow. The one who does the cleansing became the unclean person. The transferred identity, transferred contamination. Yes, Daniel.
So, I just read about this. So this man was thinking with his carnal mind when he made that vow.
Right. Because God listened.
Because the normal house at that time, they would bring the animals in at night, and they the animals were the first thing that would leave the house in the morning.
Right.
So that's what he expected.
An animal.
An animal.
Right.
Not his daughter.
Right. So I have a question for you. He thought he was making a good dad. That there's a good chance, good probability that the animal will be out there first. Who inspired the daughter to come out? God. Because you're absolutely right. Your point was correct. That the intuitive, the normal culture, the animals are the first things that are coming out. Whether it's a greet you or not, they're first thing they're out there eating. Because how many have a dog or a cat? Yeah, who gets fed first in the morning when you wake up? Usually the dog or the cat gets fed first. Why? Because they're up at like 5 a.m. I'm hungry. Get out of bed. Or 6 or 4, whatever time. They're hungry. Right? Take me for my walk. They're the ones who demand the most out of us early in the morning. Loud meows. They get a little angry at times. So it is normal. You're absolutely right. The intuitive thing that Jephthah was thinking was most likely an animal. That would be the logical choice. The first thing that's let out in the morning. But this morning, that was not the case.
The daughter coming out to offer herself as a sacrifice or to marry that guy?
It's not a marriage. It appears as an offering of a burnt offering. He said a burnt offering was what Jephthah had said.
So the daughter offered herself up to die.
She herself didn't plan on it.
Did it happen that way?
That's what it appears to happen that way. We do not know for certain what happened that way. We don't know for certain. It appears that way. We don't know.
So it doesn't say whether she died or not.
It doesn't specify that, but it does say he carried out his vow as he spoke. And he said the word burnt offering. There's only really one way I can imagine that. I mean, if somebody else has a better imagination than I do, I'm all ears. We don't know what the term burnt offering can be interpreted other than a physical fire. There may be another way of interpreting those words, try to make it more palatable amongst our minds, but I just don't know another way of doing it just yet. I've tried to think of the ways, but I was unsuccessful in my own head. Yes.
I suspect that because the fact that she doesn't bewail the loss of her life.
Right, that's what the oddity is. Why she's not upset by her loss of her life is a strange part of her actions.
She bewails at the fact she's never going to get married and have children. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that she was not literally offered up as a literal burnt offering, but more of a symbolic burnt offering, is that she lived out the rest of her life never being able to marry and have children.
And that was what I had interpreted. And I think that would make sense in one condition.
God would never accept a burnt offering of a human being.
Right. It's absurd, right? God wouldn't do that normally. And my inclination to, that's why I would like to believe that. I don't know, but I'd like to believe that. But in order to make that facilitate happen, she herself would have to be transferred, most likely, because it says to God, not just an offer, but to God himself, transferred from her father's household to the temple, or in this case, the tabernacle, because the temple wasn't built yet, and have to live there the rest of her natural life. That's the only way which you could mechanically fulfill that process, at least being an offering to God. Because somebody's just being celibate, that doesn't offer anything. You're just being celibate. You can live your life in the vow of celibacy and such. A widow her whole life. Yeah, Mary with Anna. That's true. Right. She dwelt or she lived at the temple or near the temple the rest of her existence. That is a possible interpretation. Because I argue the same thing, that she wasn't upset by the fact she's going to die. I mean, to me personally, I'll be a virgin, or I'm going to die. I'll be more upset with the death part. That's me. I'm a human. I'd rather, I can tolerate the, okay, I won't have relations, but to die? That's worse. I'd be more upset by that. But that's just me. Again, it's interpretation. We don't know. Jephthah is not condemned for this, is he? Your Tanakh, the New Testament, no one condemns him for what he did, which seems odd. Why would he then slaughter his daughter and not people say that was wrong? See, it does seem strange, right? But the whole point of this is that I want you to comprehend the idea that good and bad can exchange places, can move around, can be shuffled at different circumstances. The red cow can shuffle a good to a bad and a bad to a good. Moses saving people from the lack of water moves them to good, but it moved him and Aaron to bad. Jephthah, who was the firstborn, which is good, from a harlot, which wasn't good, went from his status from good, the high point, to bad, an outcast. Then as an outcast, that outcastness, the skills he learned, was then used to bring him back up to head of everything, greater than he was before, which is a good position. And then through his trust in God and vow to God, God heard him, God listened to him, God granted him what he needed, and who was even elevated higher. But then he loses his daughter, which brings him very, very low. He went from good to now bad again. The point is, good and bad, when God's working with them, he decides what is good, he decides what is bad, and he uses those tools. He shuffles them. He rearranges them. We think, oh, this is terrible. Oh, well, that's good. This is bad. No, that's us deciding what is and isn't good and bad. We are not God, though we wanted to be with Garden of Good of Knowledge, Tree, and Good and Evil. we tried to be God. Us deciding what's good and bad, but we don't make those decisions. God determines what's good and bad, and he is able to rearrange things as needed. Larry?
Well, I think if we think this out a little further, God does accept human sacrifice. Did Messiah want to die? Did Messiah,
no, he didn't.
Did Messiah die?
That is an example.
And who set that up?
That's right. He set it up. He set it up. That is true. That is a good point. I hadn't thought about that one. Yes.
I wanted to give a personal example of good and bad.
Go ahead.
Approximately 10 years ago, I had an ocular stroke out of the blue, which resulted in blindness in my left eye. Mm. And everybody says, oh, how bad that you're blind now. And approximately 3 weeks later, my husband had a massive stroke. And I took this as a sign as a good, because of this disability, I was off of work and I was able to take care of my husband.
Strange, isn't
so
it?
So God worked his ways to do something bad, but make good out of it.
Make a good out of it. Just flip it around for us. So as long as we can understand that good does not always produce good, and bad does not always produce bad, and that what we as humans perceive and judge as good is not necessarily good. What we judge as bad is not necessarily bad. We make those judgments, but we are not supposed to be judging those things, are we? Because we are determining those things based on we ate the tree of the fruit, the knowledge of good and evil. Because we wanted to be judges like God is a judge. We want to determine what is good and what is bad like God does. But God's saying, you can't do that. You don't know. You don't understand. God understands what's good, what's bad. And it's very different than what we understand. There was an analogy brought up earlier, I had heard earlier today, about the pieces on a play, the game board. The characters on the game board, they themselves do not comprehend the players who are outside the game board. You yourself are a player on the game board. You're just a little piece moving around. You cannot comprehend the thought process by the person who's moving you. All you see is what's around you. You see, oh, I'm a chess. Oh, well, kill that pawn, or I'm checkers, or jump over that character. But the one who's watching the board is outside your world. So you, as a player, may think, well, I should do this, and I should do that, and this is right, and that's right, and this is wrong, and that's wrong. But the player on the outside says, no, you have no clue what you're doing. I control it. What you think is right, I say is wrong. I may say, hey, I'm going to sacrifice you, lose this character, my checkerboard, on purpose, because I want something else that's greater. Get the picture? Hopefully we get the picture. It's important to understand these ideas. We decide in our own minds what we think is good and bad, and it isn't right. We may have an idea of how God wants us to live. Here's our game book. Here's the book that he wrote for us characters to follow on, our Torah to follow. But we ourselves didn't write it. We don't know why everything is the way it is. We don't need to know why, because we are not the players. We're playing the game. We're just the character. Yes, gentlemen.
So this reminds me of Proverbs, because it says a man can prepare his heart, but what comes out of the mouth is from God. And same thing with our paths. We can have a thought we're going to be going this way, but he directs our steps. Mm-hmm.
We think we're doing it, but we're not.
We're not.
We're not. Now, well, what about free will? Well, yeah, there's free will. We're discussing that part. Versus the overall God's plan. Because I make my mistakes in life, and so do you. I make my good decisions in life, and so do you. We think, oh, well, I made this one, that one turned out well. Oops, that one turned out poorly. Oops. Good, yes, what? Yeah, we make those decisions. But as long as we realize the one playing the game is the one in charge, we'll make out okay. Whatever happens. Yes.
I find it, isn't it written, he says, I bring good and I bring bad.
Yep. I bring good, I bring bad. God does it.
Right. I mean, and I think the commentary section in the Brit Hadashah, there's so much about guarding your mind, putting on mm-hmm. the full armor of God, mm-hmm. because the winds are going to flow of good and bad through the
yep.
life.
Yep, all around you.
What's the mindset? What's yep. the heart condition? Yep. And how are you still moving forward?
Yep. And how do you determine in your, as a player, your character, how do you determine what is good and what how to move forward?
Right, because it's not about me.
No,
it's not. In the end game, it's not about me. There's other people right. that I need to be a light and an overflow mm-hmm. so that energy affects them.
Right.
And hopefully that catches like wildfire, the goal.
That's the goal. Because our Tanakh, our Torah, and our Tanakh all combined teach us those things. So as long as we play these rules, I'm using the analogy of a game board. This is a very big game board, our Torah. It's a big one. It's a way of life. So as long as we are on God's team, we're his characters, we're his players, he can use us. So stay within it, within the Torah, within his instruction, you stay on the game board. Jump off it, guess what happens? You're done. You're no longer on God's team, you were captured by the other guys. The opponent took you. And it's a silly analogy, but it makes sense, it's simple. The body with the soul. Exactly.
It is like a game. It's like a
it is like a game. Yeah.
You lose your life. Oh, you're going to have a new one.
Right, right.
He's the one that can fix it.
He's the one who can fix it. So it's a very interesting concept, but keep that in mind at all times. So we interact. How many of you people, everybody interacts with people outside, your coworkers, your friends, of all spectrums, good, bad, evil, rotten, whatever. They're all over the place, right? Pay attention to what team side you're on, and know the opponents in front of you might be a friend, an acquaintance, coworker, whatever, might be on God's team also, might not be. But just because they are or are not is none of our business, but God determines it. God says, yeah, he doesn't look like he's on your team, but just wait. Or, yeah, he looks like he's on your team, but he's not. Just wait. So God makes these determinations. We don't judge based on what we see. Because our judge will be totally messed up. We'll get the red heifer thing flipped. So don't do that. It's hard, because it's our nature to say, well, I don't want to do that way. Which is good. You make discernments. But we base it on our Torah. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for the Shabbat day of rest, our time with you, our time to study and focus and listen to your voice. Father, help us to follow as best we can, for you are wise. And help us to trust you. And above all, be patient. For you decide, and you decide when, as well as how. Father, we ask you to bless us the rest of our Shabbat together as we visit and fellowship with one another. We praise you, Father, in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info.